This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is The Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makokotlela. Welcome, Lions.
Dumela, Gary, and Dumela to our podcasters. And yeah, it's Tuesday, but a heavy Tuesday. South Africa, we are mourning the passing of the mother of the nation, Mama Mandela. May his soul rest in peace.
Cool. Lions, today's show is about what we call an unsung hero. And the behind-the-scenes actuary in the Essie Dimeni hearings, he's the man who, on behalf of the families, made the calculations to counter what I call the piss-poor 200,000 rand per family, which was offered or tendered by the government in full and final settlement. That's what they offered, 200,000.
Gary, so, that's a very emotional topic. Life is dimming was something else.
But yeah, 200,000 lines is outrageous. The judge, who was the arbitrator, he said the delinquent department made the derisive offer of 200,000 rand per family. It's a shocker. It's an absolute disgrace for what the department did to those mental patients, many of whom died, were tortured, or have just vanished.
And some cannot be traced even today.
Yeah. The finger in the eye offer is what I call it. Our guest today is the actuary who dedicated a large chunk of his time and expertise to crunch the numbers. Welcome to you, Greg Whittaker.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks, Lionel.
Thank you. I'm sure your persuasive helpfulness as an actuary assisted the judge when he made his award. He didn't quite mention it, but I'm sure that he took it into account.
Yeah, I think it was just important to put a number on the table. It's because the large part of the claim was for constitutional damages. There's no real precedent in terms of calculating constitutional damages, so we just made an attempt to provide some sort of parameter at for the hearings.
Yeah. The story's got a mountain of coverage, media coverage, over the last few weeks and months, but I don't think anyone has touched on how the calculations were made and how the judge got to the figures. So we're gonna dwell on that today. Let's give out our details lines, our Facebook page. I'll give that one, The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg. You want to give the Twitter handle?
Yes, at Hertzlaw, H-E-R-T-Z-A-W. And you can always just like our page on Facebook. And if you've got any legal issues that you would like us to assist you with in terms of us actually talking about the subject matter, you can do so by touching base on the Facebook page. And we'll make it a point that we find a specialist within that specific area of law to really talk and unpack the trouble that you might be facing.
Our partner today, Legal Talk South Africa, with their tens of thousands of members, will be taking one or two questions from their members as well.
Yeah, and the partnership is constantly growing, and thank you very much to all the podcasters who are constantly downloading the podcast and listening and sharing that information with their loved ones.
Yeah. Okay, Greg Whittaker. Greg, you've done over the years, hundreds if not thousands of road accident matters where you've given your calculations as to what people are entitled to. How did you get involved in this very case?
In this particular matter, Section 27 just approached me in August last year. I have done some matters for them in the past as well. So they just came to have an initial discussion just to sort of brainstorm a few ideas around how one could go about putting some value on a matter such as this, in a case where, you know, in a normal damages claim or a normal loss of support claim where someone dies, it's ordinarily there's a claim for lost earnings, so that the dependents would be entitled to a portion of what the deceased would have earned. This is a completely different matter where all of the people involved were long-term psychiatric patients. They weren't providing support to family members. Mm. So just the character of the calculation is completely different.
Let's give a little bit of a mention to Section 27. We know it's a public interest law centre. Their website is section2727inumber.org.za if anyone wants to have a look at it. They do an enormous amount of great work, don't they, Greg?
They do. They've done a lot of high profile matters. They did the Michael Kamapi pit toilet drowning matter. I think that's still awaiting judgment. Mm. This matter consumed the time of two attorneys on, I think, a full-time basis for a couple of years, Sasha Stevenson and Umanyana Rugege. So I think they were pretty much full-time on this matter. They've done a lot of work around textbook delivery. Mm-hmm. So they focus, Section 27 is effectively Section 27 of the Constitution, and that deals with healthcare, food, water, and social security. So just a person's right access to healthcare services, sufficient food and water, social security, those are the areas that they focus on.
Now, we know that the Department of Health, is it, the government we call them, they made an offer at some point, either before the trial or during the trial, I think it was during the trial, they made a paltry offer of $200,000 per family. Yeah. Now, you had to do it before, you had to conceptualize a real claim for these people. How did you go about doing this? Because there's no precedent for this kind of claim, is there?
No, there isn't. Because as I said, in a common law claim, there's normally three things that are claimed. One is funeral expenses, which they settled, I think, towards the end of the trial, the second last day or the last day, at 20,000 Rand. And then a claim for emotional shock, which I think they settled on 180,000 Rand. And that's just based on past case law precedent. And then, obviously, the loss of support claim, which is invariably the largest component of a claim in the event of death, that fell away because it wasn't a normal dependence action.
So, sorry, Greg, if you lose a child, God forbid, in a motor collision, right now you get nothing.
Well, effectively, just the funeral expenses.
Yes.
So,
and if you lose a mother or you lose a brother who's not your breadwinner, to your family, you get nothing as well.
Yeah, that's the sort of standpoint with like road accident fund claims. So that's based on common law, and common law is just precedent, really. So
now, this is what the government was wanting to offer the families in this case. They said, well, you can't get more than that. Shock, funeral expenses, and we'll give you a little bit, and that's it. Go away.
So they were relying on just the common law claim and nothing in constitutional damages.
Okay, you came along and said there are constitutional damages which you want to calculate. This is something novel in our law. Precedent, really.
There have been a handful of cases. I think the one matter that comes to mind that was cited by Justice Mosoneke in the judgment was the Kate matter, which was a matter where a lady claimed for social grant payments, and that she was delayed by, I think, 2 or 3 years, and then she was awarded interest on the payments as constitutional damages. It wasn't a large amount. I think because of the multitude of the number of parts of the Constitution that were violated in this matter, I think what we had in mind was just because the normal you normally look at placing the dependents in the same position that they would have been had the unlawful death not occurred. We just said, well, let's look at it from the other side and put the perpetrator in the same position as they would have been. And then we started investigating. The main crux of my report was to say, well, what would this have cost? And that's a saving. And then Once you've got the total saving, we can just work out the average per person.
Okay, so let's go a little slow, Greg. You were handed the entire electronic data file representative of all the people that were either killed or died or vanished or still alive.
I had a data file for my final report of 143 people that had died. There was one further person added, which towards the end of the trial. So my electronic data file was basically 143 deceased. And then we set about trying to calculate, well, what would that total saving have been in respect of those people.
Okay, you had bipolar patients, you had whatever, every mental disease imaginable. You had to then work out what their life expectancy would have been. Is that kind of where you
went?
That's
right. So what one would have to do is once you have this group of people project what their likely future lifetime would have been, because that impacts on how much the total cost would have been. So in this particular case, because we didn't have data on. Yeah, well, the diagnosis for every single person, because in some cases, some patients were transferred without medical records or even identity numbers. So
they vanished with their records.
We don't have. And also, even if you do have a diagnosis, there's so many things that come into play. In terms of, for example, like bipolar, when was the last episode, and that has an effect on life expectancy. When one goes in. So we looked at a whole lot of international studies around the life expectancy of mental health patients, and then once we had done that, then we looked at are there any local studies? And there was a local study at Vestkorpis, but in that particular study, they didn't find that there was much of a difference between the mortality experience of mental health care patients versus the general population. But when you take the analysis further, you have to compare that to, well, what were they comparing the mortality experience to? And they were comparing it to a fairly heavy table of mortality, which included HIV, AIDS deaths, and so on. So there wasn't the comparison table. That has a big effect on ultimately how you allow for a reduction in life expectancy.
So, Greg, what you really did was you worked out what the age was, what his condition was, and then you said if he was still alive, he would have been housed by the government in a facility at so much per annum, and that would have cost the government X. Therefore, the government must kind of compensate for that. Is that how you...
Yeah, so we just said like they would have paid... In the ordinary course of events, had they stayed at Life Vesta Mini, they would have paid X per month.
Yes.
I think it was close to 10 or 11,000 rand per month, just 120 rand per day. They would have paid that over their remaining lifetime, and that would have been a certain value based on the life expectancy. What we did do in the final calculation, and we pieced it all together from various... I think it was the CEO of Life Vesta Mini mentioned that there had been 462 deaths at their facilities over the period from October 2011 to June 2016. And then we related that to the number of hospital beds or the number of beds they had in their various facilities, which we reconstructed from their financial statements. So we did a little bit of... we really exhausted the data that we had.
We're minimizing it because I asked you before the show, I said, let's just keep it light because otherwise we're going to lose people if we really get into the nitty gritty. Bottom line, Greg, you spent an inordinate amount of time on this one. Do you know roughly how many hours you spent? Probably 50 or 100 hours.
Probably somewhere between the 50 and 100 hours, I'd say.
Okay, so it wasn't a matter of just sitting down and
We did there was a lot of background reading on international studies into life expectancy for mental health care users. And then we decided that there was no better projection than to use the actual experience of Life Vesta Mini. So we were able to reconstruct that. And it just so happened that it ended up being fairly close to one of the studies that Professor Makhoba, the healthcare ombudsman, mentioned in his second report. So yeah. We got to a very similar.
What figure did you get to?
In terms of we said the average life expectancy for in the normal course of events would have been about 21 years. So the average age of the I think we had an average age of around about
55.
Yeah. So if you looked at the average of it would be roughly 21 years. And then what we ended up doing our calculations on was another 14 years. So we allowed for a 7-year reduction in life expectancy due to the loadings that we applied.
What's the figure you came to? That you gave in court? Yeah.
Yeah. We recommended about 1.5 million per family. So our calculations just focused on the deceased. Whereas the ruling does provide compensation to people who survived as well.
You did this pro bono, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, the whole thing free.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. Amazing. Wow. There's a question that came through from someone on Legal Talk. It's from Joy De Silva. I'll give her name. She said, my brother was one of the patients that was moved to an illegal NGO. And when all the news broke, he was moved in the middle of the night to an unknown facility, and she spent days trying to track him down, etc. And then he was moved around. I'm going to cut it short. She wants to know, she wants to know who's entitled to get what? Which patients, is it also the patients that vanish, their families? Who gets what? In terms of the eventual arbitration award,
if I could specifically deal with what the ruling, what the various amounts were. So there were 63 families of deceased that were represented by Section 27. That was the one category of claimants. Mm. There was another category of claimants that were four families of deceased that were represented by, I think it was Hertha Spies attorneys, and then there were 68. Patients that had survived the transfer, and they were represented by the Legal Aid Board. So the arbitration ruling specifically deals with them. However, there is a paragraph in the arbitration ruling, if I can read, where Justice Morsenecki says, I'm not unmindful of the fact that many other potential claimants are not before me in these proceedings. I'm aware of many public announcements and media advertisements that invited potential claimants. Not all have joined the process. When they find their voice or way, I trust that the government would choose to meet their claim in terms identical to the award than to set up new litigation of another arbitration process.
So if anyone comes out the woodwork, he'll get what everyone else got.
If the government entertains
it. What is the exact award that was given by the judge?
So the... There was an award of 20,000 rand for funeral expenses, 180,000 rand for general damages for shock and psychological trauma, and then 1 million rand in constitutional damages. So
is that to everyone across the board?
So the total is 1.2 million rand, but that would only be in respect of the deceased or the families of the deceased. And then, obviously, for the survivors, the 20,000 rand would fall away for funeral expenses. So that would, they would just get one. I think it's 1,180,000.
You want to ask last?
Yeah, I just want to know, who does the money go to? In this case, let's say the mother passed away. Does it go into a trust account and somebody administer the amount, the trust account in terms of actually distributing the money?
I don't think there's any trust account there. In the arbitration ruling does. Give a family representative per deceased. So
we hope the money's not squandered and people don't go buy cars and leather jackets.
No, because I foresee.
But what should they do with the money if you've lost a loved one? I guess that I don't know.
Well, look, one of the things that they the original claim of Section 27 for constitutional damages mentioned in the arbitration ruling was 1.5 million, and they. The families wanted to donate 500,000 rand to be paid into the mental health care system in Gauteng in memory of each deceased and to improve the care of mental health care users in the province. So they, their intention was to, had they got the 1.5 million, they would have donated 500,000 back to the province.
Talking of donations, what did the arbitrator, Judge Morsenecki, do with his fee?
Well, he's donated it to law schools. Yeah. Yeah.
Marvelous gesture, isn't it?
I think it's
we incredible. Try to guess. I mean, what would an arbitrator earn per day? Anything 15,000 to 50,000? We don't know.
No, not sure.
He was going this arbitration lasted how many days?
It was 43 days and then 2 days of argument. So 45 days all in all. So could have been a fairly substantial fee.
Plus then all his time for writing the judgment, research, time before the hearing.
It could be a few million,
we don't know.
I'm not too sure. But
very generous of him, a marvelous man.
Incredible.
Yeah. He never became Chief Justice, which is a great tragedy. Politically, there's a reason why. Yes. I think Mbeki and Zuma and whatever. but he deserved to be. You sat and watched him, and you gave evidence in front of him.
Yeah.
He was very involved in this case, wasn't he?
Incredibly involved, yeah. And it's just incredible to...
Sometimes judges kind of half fall asleep. But
It's undoubtedly my career highlight to just give evidence in front of someone like that.
You were cross-examined quite strenuously, weren't you, Greg, by the government's lawyers?
Yes. There were a few questions around life expectancy. They had cited certain international studies, but I was just pointed out that you can't sort of make a statement that someone's got a reduction in life expectancy of 25 years without relating it to their age and so on. So there were just sort of some sort of broad questions around life expectancy, and then there were also questions about, did we take into account the fact that in the ordinary course of the events, some of these patients may have been moved to back home or to another facility and so on. Our calculations were specifically focused on what would it have cost to keep these people in Malathis Dimeni, because what transpired afterwards is, what Justice Mosinecki questions in the ruling is, was cost saving really the reason for the transfer?
And do we get the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't think anyone. It never came out, did it?
No.
Yeah. Transformation in your profession as an actuary is taking place very fast, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's a lot of good programs in place. We've got an actuarial development trust, quite a few actuaries, myself included, make contributions to the trust, and that funds the university fees of disadvantaged students, and there's an actuarial society educational trust, which is also doing incredible work in terms of maths education in South Africa. So we've partnered with there's a particular product, paper video, where you can basically scan a QR code and get a pop-up lesson on your cell phone to deal with a maths problem in a workbook. So,
yeah, the actuaries are known to be, you have kind of genius qualities, you actuaries. I mean, it's a known fact. In order to become an actuary, you have to have great math marks, don't you?
Yeah, I think I was speaking to Professor Stephen Gerish at WITS a while back, and I think he mentioned, I think most of their first year intake have got more than 90% for school matric maths.
Sure. Wow.
So I think their intake is around about 180 to 200 students, and they're generally all...
Do they get past first year, a lot of them?
The attrition rate is normally high in first year. I'm not sure of the exact numbers. It might be sort of 40%.
The relevance of your evidence, testimony, and the reliability of what you had to say is probably something that the judge relied on. Although he doesn't mention you by name, at least he was secure in awarding the amount that was quite close to what you suggested.
I think at least just put a parameter on the table is useful. And that's it's sometimes a tactic that one could use. I mean, it's not always... there's actually quite a nice Supreme Court of Appeal judgment from that basically paved the way for actuaries in the damages space, where they said that there's sort of two approaches available to a court in assessing loss of earnings in this particular matter, and the one was sort of a guesswork, and the other one was to rely on some mathematical calculation based on assumptions which may be strongly probable to speculative. So, they say, well, the result of an actuarial calculation may be no more than an informed guess. It's got the advantage of an attempt to ascertain the value of what was lost on a logical basis. Whereas like a judge's gut feeling as to what is fair and reasonable is no more than a blind guess.
As a lawyer, I wouldn't know how much to award. I don't know whether you would, Lyne, and I think what you gave is what he relied on, probably.
I don't know. I know he expressed some concerns about, I think something that he was grappling with quite a lot was treating each life the same. Because what often happens I think he mentioned it on the second last day, if an actuary and a gardener are killed in the same accident, the actuary's dependents would get like 1,000 times what the gardener's dependents would get, and is that really fair? I mean, yes, we have this like common law that's developed, but is it right? And shouldn't everybody, you know, if you killed in exactly the same circumstances, shouldn't you all get the same amount?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something that people have been grappling with for a long, long time, dating back to biblical times.
Yeah, I think our labor laws say it's across the board. If you're the sweeper or whether you're the shop steward, I mean, if there's an increase, that everyone shares in
it. Yeah, that's a principle that's... That's applied there.
There's a lovely joke. I'm sorry to make a joke at your expense. There's a guy who probably is an actuary, Mitchell Kaplan. He says, I once told an actuary to go to the end of the line. He came back 5 minutes later and said he couldn't because someone else was already there. There you go. Only an actuary would come up with that. Well done. You're our hero of the week. Greg Whittaker, what's the old company's name, please?
It's Algorithm Consultants and Actuaries.
Yeah.
But I think, just to touch base on this, how important it is for one to actually get an opinion. Let's say I was involved in an accident and where we need to determine the value, because most of the people needs that, but they don't know how to access actuaries and so forth.
It normally comes via an attorney. So normally you get typical road accident fund matter. The claimant will go to the attorney, and then the claimant is assessed by a variety of experts that they deem are necessary, and then sort of actuaries are normally the last in line in terms of actually quantifying what the amount would be.
So one cannot come directly to you guys without an
generally answer. It's generally not done that way, because you normally we reliant on other experts in terms of the prognosis of future earnings and so on.
Alright, thank you.
Greg Whittaker, many thanks for joining us today. Thanks for giving us insight into the calculations. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
We'll talk to you again. To anyone listening live, please don't go away, because we have another segment now. It's on sureties and summary judgment. Very good one. We'll be right back.
This is CliffCentral.com.